Be turning to Hebrews the 11th chapter. I know some are saying still. Hopefully we're going to finish chapter 11 and move into chapter 12 this evening. We have been discussing the way that the Hebrew writer has presented the chapter. And he's began talking about Abel, then Enoch, and as he has gone down through these, we have come now to a section that I've called the patriarchs. And we've talked about Abraham and Sarah. And so last time when we ended, we had gotten down to Isaac and in verse, let's see, about verse 20, that's where we want to start this evening. It says, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. Again, we see the importance of faith here relative to the blessing of Jacob and Esau by Isaac. And he says he blessed them concerning things to come. One of the things that we need to keep indelibly in our mind as we go through this 11th chapter is he's talking about people that never saw the fulfillment of the promises that were made to them. And yet his point is they look for those things by faith. They look forward to something by faith that they had never seen, they would never experience themselves, but they knew that it was there, and we will see that when we get to talking about Joseph. But it says of Isaac blessing Jacob and Esau that it was relative to things to come. And these are things, I think, that he's saying relative to God's promises. First to Abraham, then to Isaac, Jacob, and on down, these promises were continually made to them. And so he's dealing with the things that would be yet in the future. Then in verse 21, he says, by faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on the top of his staff. Two sons of Joseph were Ephraim and Manasseh. And you remember that Jacob essentially adopts them and makes them heads of tribes. And so this blessing was a significant thing. The blessing that he talks about here relative to Isaac and then Jacob, they were about things of the future, things that were yet to come. And so he's talking about how it was by faith that they continued to look forward to those things. Going on down, then, let's see, in verse 22, by faith Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. Even Joseph, who had been separated the better part of his life from his family, from all of these things that were going on, still understood that there was something that was yet to come that was better. And it seems to me, and we'll talk more about this in a moment, that the Hebrew writer is trying to stress to these Hebrew Christians the fact that they have that which is better. And what they are in danger of going back to is that which is inferior, that which is not better. And he's trying to stress how all of these great heroes of faith endured great difficulties. And they endured them not having the things that the Hebrew Christians have. And so why would the Hebrew Christians give up that which they have, that which has come to them? And we'll see that in just a moment. And so then we get we've talked about Jacob and Joseph. Now we get to Moses. And he begins to talk about Moses in verse 23. He says, "By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's commands." You remember what the king's commands were? That all the male children of the Hebrews would be put to death. Because the Hebrews were growing in number, and the king was afraid that they were going to be able to just overrun the country. And so he took steps. Now, the faith that he talks about, it's interesting here, verse 23 says, "By faith, Moses." Moses was an infant. Not talking about Moses' faith here. Whose faith is he talking about? The parents' faith. The parents are the ones that understood the significance. And they're the ones that made sure Moses lived. Now, so then, look at verse 24. "By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter." It's interesting to me how things change over time. The Hebrew writer says, when Moses came of age, how old was he? In Acts 7, Stephen says of him, he was 40 years old. That's when he came of age. We think, I can remember when I was much, much younger. When I was 16, 17, 18, nobody could tell me anything. I knew it all then. I was of age. I could drive a car. I could do things on my own. Stephen says when Moses was 40 years old, the Hebrew writer says when he came of age, when he was able to deal with the things, says that he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And so here we see faith being the refusal of faith. In verse 25, "Choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures for a season." Passing pleasures of sin. We'll get it here in a minute. So Moses understood. And if you just stop and think about this, he's 40 years old. He has lived his entire life in the lap of luxury. He has power. He has wealth. He has prestige as part of the Egyptian court. And yet the Hebrew writer says he knew there was something better. He knew that there was something that was far superior even to wealth, to power, to prestige. And he was willing to give all of that up rather than enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. And then he says in verse 26, "Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward." There's the key. The reward wasn't in riches. The reward wasn't in power and wealth. He knew that there was a reward that awaited out there. And again, I emphasize, he never saw these things come about. He never saw the Messiah. Yet, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater than the treasures, greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. And so we see Moses as he refuses to remain in the court because of his faith. And he understands that there's reproach associated with that. But he is willing to endure that. And then going on down. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch him. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. He makes a point here about the reward of faith. That's what Moses was looking forward to. He looked to the reward. And so he forsook Egypt. There are those, you know, who say he fled Egypt because of his fear of Pharaoh because he killed the Egyptian. Not what the Hebrew writer says. Notice what he says. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Didn't see him. Never would see him. But he understood the significance of what he could not see. Go back to chapter 1 and verse 1. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Don't you think Moses had some evidence that caused him to forsake all that he had ever known in Egypt? We're not told what all evidence he had. He was obviously taught by his mother when he was very young. And that stuck with him. But just think, after 40 years of being involved in that environment, think about Jerry's lessons this morning about Samson. And how he succumbed to the lust of the flesh and the pulls of the world around him very easily. And here was Moses who grew up that way. And yet he was willing to give all of that up. And that's one of the strong points the Hebrew writer is making here about the faith of Moses. And then we see how faith wins, ultimately, with Joshua and Rahab. How do you say that? Rahab. Got it. Says by faith, this is verse 30, by faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. By faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. She's identified as a harlot. If you go back and you look at the Hebrew word, there are some who have tried to sanitize that a little bit and tried to make her just an innkeeper. Why do you think that is? Where else does Rahab show up? Genealogy of Christ in Matthew. And so, sometimes we try to help God out a little bit, and we try to sanitize things to make it all kind of fit. Who wants a harlot showing up in the genealogy of Christ? But I don't think you can get around it. I think that's what she was. And if you look at every other translation, that's basically the same way they translate it. New American Standard, the English Standard, the New Living Bible, all of them. She was a prostitute. And yet the Scripture says that she did not perish with those who did not believe because she hid the spies. It's also kind of interesting to me when you think about Joshua. And I'm sure Joshua is thinking about the outcome of the first time that spies were sent into the land of Canaan by Moses. And he was one of them. But the outcome wasn't very good. 10 of them said, "We can't do this." And so Joshua picks two spies to go in. It says two young men. I don't know how they got across the Jordan River at this point. It doesn't say. It just says he sent them into Jericho. And they were to spy out Jericho, and then they were to report back to Joshua. This was not just going to be a general publication. But they were to report back, but they were almost discovered until Rahab hid them. And she hid them on the basis that she would be spared when Jericho was taken. And that's what the Hebrew writer is saying, that her faith brought that about. And then beginning in verse 32, he just kind of sums up a bunch here when he says, "And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of swords, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to fight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trials and mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonments. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. All of these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us." Here's his summation to these Hebrew Christians. He says, "We just don't have time to go into detail about all of the people." And so he just kind of lumps a great number of them. And these, we need to keep in mind, these are people before the Messiah. These are Old Testament people. And he's using this to show the significance of what they endured, what they went through. And he sums it up when he says in verse 39, "did not receive the promise." He's saying they did not see it fulfilled in their lifetime. Yet they endured all of those kind of trials, persecutions, death, living destitute. God having provided something better for us. Here's the contrast. Look at what they endured. And they did it because of their faith in what was in yet the future. They never did see it. But he said, God has provided it for us, for you and for me, for these Hebrew Christians. God has given that to us. And he says that they should not be made perfect apart from us. What is he saying there about these people? What he's saying, if the Messiah had not come, what about these people? They'd just be left without chart or compass, wouldn't they? They wouldn't be any better off. And he says they did all of these things depending upon what God had promised about future blessings. That's the key. That's the point he's trying to get across to these Christians who are in danger of drifting away, going back to something that is easier. And he's saying, don't do that. Because you are giving up that which has value. You're giving up that which is superior to anything that you would be going back to. And as we talked about some weeks ago, what they're going back to, while it might still be in process up until AD 70, and I think this was written in the 60s sometime, so the temple was still there, the sacrifices were still being offered. But in a few years, Titus and the Roman army is going to come through and put a stop to all of that when they destroy the temple in Jerusalem. And he's trying to get them to see that what they're in danger of going back to is going to actually cease to totally exist. You're not going back to anything. And so he's just encouraging them to continue to be faithful as these people are faithful. Think about what James says about Rahab, that she was justified by her works and by her faith. Here was a Gentile woman who was a prostitute who winds up in the lineage of Christ. And she did it because of her faith. It's like Jerry said this morning. Sometimes we just kind of throw up our hands because we think that we're failures, that we're not able to do certain things, and we forget what God can do with us. And in spite of their, not all of these people in this chapter 11, they all had problems. They all had warts. But they overcame those things. And in spite of that, they're listed in this group of Christians, or in this group of people who showed great faith. Any questions or comments before we leave chapter 11? Jerry?
There are two things in this passage that I really like. One is that first part of verse 38, of whom the world was not worthy. He's saying that about people who really the world thought weren't worthy of the world. And that's why they were stoning them and they were afflicting them and tormenting them. You're not worthy to live in this world, is what the world is saying. And what the Hebrew writer was saying is the exact opposite.
Yeah.
The world is not worthy of these people living in it. And you look at verse 35, women receive their dead raised to life again. Where my mind goes with that is back to Elijah and Elisha. You have, especially with Elijah there in 1 Kings 17, you have the widow of Zarephath. And here's a woman who was starving to death.
Yeah.
With her and her son. And Elijah comes to them, and the barrel of flour never, or the jar of flour never runs out, and then the boy dies, and Elijah raises him from the dead. And you think, well, what worth is a widow woman who doesn't even have the wherewithal to feed herself? And what the Hebrew writer says is the world wasn't worthy of it.
Yeah.
Because of the faith that she had. That's the first thing. That second thing is that they should not be made perfect apart from us. Where are we in Hebrews chapter 11? You know, you've got Abel and Enoch and Noah and Abraham and all of these great people, and you think, man, I could never attain that. Well, the fact of the matter is, we're there.
Yeah.
And what he says is, we're the end of that story. We're the fulfillment.
We're what they were looking forward to.
Exactly. And the story of them is not complete without us. We're the completion of that story.
Right.
And so I agree with you, his whole focus here is on faith. Go back to Judaism, which at this point is a faithless religion. You go back to that, and you have no story. You stay with Jesus Christ. You live by faith, and you're in the same hall of faith as Abel and Enoch
and Noah. Right up there with the rest of them. Yes.
This settles the argument about what James means by faith and works.
Right.
It's the best commentary on the book of James that's ever been written.
Right. That these people demonstrated their faith by the things that they did. All right, good. Let's move into chapter 12 then. And as we come into chapter 12, there are two themes that kind of run through this chapter. One is on athletics, the other one is on citizenship. And the first one, he pictures a race here, beginning in verse 1 through about verse 13. And then, beginning in verse 14, he talks about citizenship in the heavenly city. Now, the people would have understood that in this time, in order to compete in official games, you had to be a citizen of the nation. You had to be a Roman citizen when this was written. In order to compete in official games in the Colosseum. So these people understood that. But there is one other theme that runs through this whole chapter. And that theme is endurance. Enduring all of the things that we face today. He's talked about all these people in chapter 11, what they faced and how they overcame. Now he's making it personal. Now he's saying, knowing what you know about all these people, here's what you have to do. I'm one that, because of my background as an engineer, I'm very logical in a sense that things have to fit together for me. When I was preaching full time and I would find someone's sermon that I liked real well, it would take me about a week to put it together so it fit me. I think I did a sermon on the Jordan some time back. First time I heard it was from Foy Vinson in Springdale, Arkansas in 1991 or two. And I also read it in McGarvey's handbook in the late 1800s, so Foy wasn't original either. But the point is that it took me a long time to get that sermon to fit how I wanted to deliver it. And so I look for those kind of things as I go through. And as we come into chapter 12, I want to suggest some things to you about what we have seen in Hebrews up to this point. Started out in chapter 1 and goes through about chapter 10, talking about the superiority of Christ. He shows him to be superior to angels, to prophets, to Moses. And then in chapter, the last two or three chapters, he shows the priesthood of Christ to be superior to the priesthood of Aaron. And so he's established in those first 10 chapters why Christ is superior to anything that they had under the law. And then as we come into chapter 11, he says, all of that should lead you to faith in Christ. And he gives all of these examples of how faith worships, how faith walks, how faith works. And last week, Jerry made the comment that what we see here is faith that is infused in every part of our life. Everything that we do, we're still waiting in a sense. We're waiting for the return of Christ. And sometimes we war because of our faith. We're in a spiritual warfare, as Paul points out. Weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but they're spiritual. And we have to be prepared for that. Our faith has to be ready for that kind of thing if we expect to win, ultimately, that eternal reward. And so then as he comes into chapter 12, he says, therefore we also, in other words, just like those of chapter 11, just like those people of the Old Testament, we also, since we're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin that does so easily ensnare us, and run with endurance the race that is set before us. What he's saying is, our faith must lead us to endurance. We've seen how Christ is superior. We have that which is better available to us. We have examples of people that never did see it come about, but they endured so much looking forward to that reward. And now it's up to you, you Hebrew Christians, it's up to you and me to endure, to have the kind of faith they had, that we might ultimately obtain the reward. And so as we go into chapter 12, he gives us three resources that are given to help us with this endurance. How do we overcome? How do we continue? You know, we sometimes get discouraged because of all the things that are going on right now. The virus that has disrupted our lives to an extent that none of us have ever seen in our lifetime. The social problems that exist in our country today. All of the things that are going on in the world around us. And we can become discouraged. We can just kind of throw up our hands sometime and say, is all of this worth it? And what the Hebrew writer is saying, yes, it's all worth it. There is nothing that we encounter in our life that we cannot overcome. And there is nothing that we encounter that makes all of this worthless. They can do a lot to us. You know, Jesus says, fear him who can kill your body. He says, don't fear him. Don't fear him who can kill the body. Fear him who can kill body, both body and soul in hell. And so his point is, just think about chapter 11. Here were people that they were mocked, they were scourged, they were imprisoned, they were sawn in two. You just can't imagine some of the things that people have endured because of their faith. And so he gives us these three things to help us get through. And the first one that he gives us is in the first four verses when he says, we have the example of the Son of God. These three things are to encourage us. We said that there's two themes. One is athletics, and he pictures a race here. And so he says, these are things to help you in this race, to help you remain faithful. The first one, he says, is just look around you. Verse 1, therefore we also, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Says we're surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses. He's making reference back to chapter 11 and all of these people. was looking through a number of the translations that I have on my computer to see how other translations brought this about. And all of them talk about witnesses. But I found the Living Bible that says, since we have such a huge crowd of men of faith watching us from the grandstand. I don't like that at all. That's not what he's saying. And I think sometimes we have the picture that it's kind of like being in the Roman Colosseum and it's just packed with all of these great people of faith and we're down on the field struggling against the enemy. And they're just sitting there watching. What word comes to your mind? What English word comes to your mind from witnesses? Comes from a Greek word. We get the word martyr. That's what he's saying. We have this great cloud of martyrs. And what they're saying to us is not we're just watching to see if you endure. They're saying we endured. We overcame. It was our faith. Even though we didn't see what you have today, we overcame. And they are helping us to understand the significance and the value of endurance. And so he says, we have all of these witnesses, people that gave their life for their faith. And they teach us a great deal about the quality of faith. The quality of faith that should characterize each Christian today. They testify to us that their lives, the lives that they lived by faith, is a practical life. It is a real life. It is a life that we need to be living. And they just give testimony as to the futility of sin. Just like Jerry was saying a moment ago when he says, of whom the world was not worthy. It wasn't. They gave testimony to the futility of the sin of the world. Go back and think about Moses. He chose the reproach of Christ rather than the passing pleasures of sin. So there's the relative value of the two. He was willing to give all of that up. Then secondly, he says, look at yourself. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. He doesn't say specifically what sin he's talking about here. My personal opinion is, and if you have any other thoughts, you're welcome to make them. But my personal opinion is, based on what he said in chapter 11 and what we've seen in the preceding chapters about what these Hebrew Christians are in danger of drifting, in danger of becoming unbelievers, that this sin that he's making reference to here is the sin of unbelief. Now, we can talk about all kinds of specific things, but what is at the root of all of the rest of sin? Unbelief. If we don't believe in what God has said, if we don't believe in His Word, we're not likely to worry about any of the rest of the things that we do. Now, that's just where I've come down on it. Any other thoughts anyone has? Okay. So he says, look around at the witnesses. Look at yourself. Now look at Jesus. In verse 2. looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. Time is up this evening, so we will stop at that point, and next Sunday, the Lord willing, we will start looking at what he says about Jesus and what he went through. Just think of what he said in chapter 11 about these people. And now he says, here's the premier example that you should be focusing on. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. So we will look at that next time, the Lord willing.